Hello, everybody. This is the Andrew Luck Book Club podcast, and I am thrilled and honored to be joined by Dr. Lucy Kalanithi, the widow of Paul and mother of Katie, and then also the little bro of Paul, Jeevan Kalanithi, a tech entrepreneur, a entrepreneur in residence at Lux Capital. I want to know what that means. That's like only, I think only in Silicon Valley do you have that job title. Also, what many people say, you're the most handsome of all the brothers. Is that true as well?
Oh, no way. It's my job to step in here and say no.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
That's a question I can't answer.
You recuse yourself from that answer, that question. All right. I think there's so much to talk about. When
even you're good-looking.
So much to talk about with When Breath Becomes Air. And I feel like, you know, I'm sure... you obviously lived it, but as a reader, I think I need to begin by saying thank you for sharing Paul's story, and I should thank Paul in a way for sharing his story, but also you guys for letting it happen. It really, really was powerful, and I loved the part at the end, well, many, many parts, but I love the part at the end where he talks about the or I think it's you writing, Lucy, about the syntax of football plays, and I wish I could talk to him about the syntax of football plays. Would he really go into that?
Yeah, do you remember that, Jeevan? You three were sitting on the couch. Yeah.
That's hilarious. I would like to have him explain it to me.
He would be thrilled to talk about that.
Cool.
Yeah, go ahead, Lucy.
I mean, you can probably explain it better. I think he was just talking about like the, I don't know, like the complexity of a play and what you guys do, and like I don't know how he ended up saying syntax, but it's like it's a way of thinking about rules, right? Like that crossover, like it exists in literature, and it's also sort of like a beautiful thing in the game. So I don't know. He had the NCAA rule books.
That's intense.
Yeah, we got pretty deep into the rule book, and I think what we were talking about was this idea that you can like represent what is happening on the field, which is like a very real-time, visceral human beings doing stuff in the symbolic way.
Yeah.
It actually is representative, and it makes sense. And if you cannot understand it in both ways, then you will fail. It was an interesting conversation.
No, that sounds
like
deep.
I should say non-football players.
Yeah. Talking about football. Well, every playbook has a different language, and when you call a play, the one thread that runs common is that you have to tell people where to go, where to be, and what to do. And so there's definitely a rhythm for calling a play. So I'd like to, before we get deeper, I have to ask my obligatory Stanford questions as a graduate, and you, Jeevan, also as an undergrad. And you were a year behind Paul in school, right?
Yep.
And what freshman dorm was he in, and what freshman dorm were you in?
Okay, I was in Mirlo, and Paul was in Loro. We were both in SLE, so I kind of talked a little bit about
it. Oh, yeah, you're in FLOMO.
FLOMO, big-time FLOMO people.
I hung out at FLOMO a lot, played a lot of FIFA my freshman year at FLOMO with my buddy Sam Schwartz, being the center on the football team. Yeah, we got very close.
Oh,
hung out a lot in FLOMO.
Yeah.
And I know I got to go to school with my little sister was at Stanford 2 years behind me while I was there. And I know I loved having a sibling there. I think she didn't like it because I'd show up at parties where she was and make sure no boys talked to her and stuff like that. But I really enjoyed having her there. You guys were obviously close. I mean, he writes about you guys throwing the rattlesnake in the pillowcase into the desert in Arizona. Did you have any of those moments at Stanford?
Oh, man, more than I can count. I mean, the funny thing was I can remember applying to college and deciding where I wanted to go. And at that time, I actually did not want to go to Stanford because Paul and I were like pretty close in high school, but not really.
Yeah.
And I felt like, oh, I want to be independent. I want to go to someplace else. And then I thought to myself, this is dumb. I want to go to Stanford. It seems awesome. And I'm not going to let my brother stop me. So I just went and ended up being one of the better decisions of my life because, you know, we spent a lot of time together, a lot of time. We lived in the same dorm, Phi Sig, when I was a sophomore and he was a junior, and we just did a lot of stuff together. And I think, I don't know, just lots of aiding and abetting each other in our various things, whether we're competing in some way or just having fun together. And it was so awesome. I mean, I I can't believe, looking back, that I thought I thought maybe I wouldn't do that. And it was just dumb stuff, you know. Like, I can remember showing up my freshman year and like trying to sign up for my email address and being like, "What?" He's like, "You know,
yeah.
Okay, here's what you do." And I was like, "Oh, you can make up your own email address." I said, "Yeah, you can make it up. You can have it be your first name." I was like, "Okay, cool." To things like, you know, he got me into a lot of fun activities, so it was awesome being there, for sure. I mean, I think anybody, any sibling that are close in age, you can go to college together. I think it's an awesome idea.
I would echo that sentiment. And were you guys in any clubs together? I know Paul was in a sort of sketch comedy group. One of my girlfriend's roommate, freshman year, she was in a sketch comedy group. We loved going to those shows. They were hilarious. But what did y'all do together, maybe officially?
Oh, we did a lot of stuff. We did some sketch comedy stuff. We specialized in recruiting people with no talent, like ourselves. then we did some stuff in Stanford Band. We were field show writers 1 year and definitely got into some trouble doing that.
You made it out of LS Jump alive?
I did, yeah.
Not many people could say that.
I know. We survived. Yeah, we wrote some stuff that I still think was kind of funny.
Did you get banned from any stadiums for your writings?
Yeah, we did. So we wrote this Notre Dame show, and it really was that one.
Was it inflammatory?
The university president had to apologize to the other university. That's what happened.
That is true. That is 100% true. I didn't think it was being inflammatory, but I guess it really was. I mean, yeah.
That's funny.
It's up to you to decide what inflames people. It's what people listen to. So we did that. And then we worked at Sierra Camp together, which is awesome.
Okay, yeah. I've heard a lot of folks when we were in school there that loved going. It was really neat reading in the book about his experience there. Reminds me a lot of my little brother. He's a big outdoors. I think his life goal is to be a park ranger at a national park. So we talked about that.
It's so beautiful there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we did a lot of stuff together, and really it was Paul who kind of pointed me in the direction of these things. I mean, we didn't study exactly the same stuff, but a lot of the activities we did were similar. I can remember at Sierra Camp, he was like, "Hey, you should apply to this thing," and he introduced me to a bunch of the people that were getting together at the Coho, which is this coffee house on campus.
Oh, yeah,
and I met these people, and I was like, "These people are psychos. I do not want to be a part of this." But then after I got to know them and I just decided to apply anyways, I was like, that was one of my more formative experiences at Stanford, for sure, working up in Tahoe in the summer. So, yeah, it was awesome having an older brother at college with me.
That's fantastic. Okay, so, since you talked about Sierra Camp, I have to ask, and Lucy, it seems like you and Paul got a lot of enjoyment of hiking in the Bay Area and in Northern California, and it seems like that was maybe your escape from work, in a sense. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason we moved here, actually. I went to school in New Hampshire, and then we met in New Haven. Yep. I don't know why. I don't know how Paul, like, got over the hump to come to the East Coast after living here for 4 years. I think, you know, especially when you spend all those hours in the hospital as residents, if you can step outside, you suddenly feel like yourself again. You sort of feel like you're re-entering your own body after being so focused on other people's experience and other people's bodies in the hospital. It's like this really interesting, rejuvenating thing, I think, to be outside. That was a big piece of what we liked to do, for sure.
Yeah. Did you ever do the Windy Hill hike?
Yeah.
Okay, I love that. I did
you
that.
Like that one?
I did. I did that 2 days before my surgery this year. I said, "If there's one thing I'm gonna do in the Bay Area, it's gonna go hike Windy Hill." It's a great view at the top too. We saw someone paragliding down. They'd run off the top, the knoll, but didn't make it. They didn't make it. they fell halfway, which was a little depressing, but.
Which way did they go? Did they go toward the ocean?
No. Down towards towards the bay. Yeah, like towards campus, towards the dish.
Oh, man, that's nice.
Yeah, the dish. That's another one. Do you guys ever walk the dish?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, I did that a couple of months ago.
Oh, really? That's cool. That is cool. So, Lucy, you mentioned that y'all met at Yale in medical school. From an outsider looking in, medical school seems so, I think hellish is one word that comes to mind, and tough. And you know, what are those days like? How can you connect with other people when you're working and studying so hard and maybe you can share a little bit about your relationship early on with Paul in New Haven.
Yeah, sure. So we both showed up as first year med students. It was funny because we were in the same class, and the first thing I knew about Paul, almost the first thing, was he came to med school and he was worried. He'd been this like sketch comedian, like Jeevan was saying, super funny, like smart, curious guy, but really funny and pretty relaxed. And he showed up at med school and was like very nervous that med school was going to make him less interesting, or it was going to sort of like be, you know, it was going to make him too serious or something. And so he actually was standing in the line where you get your photos taken for your med school ID, and like goes up to the front of the line, turns around to get his photo taken against the white background, and out of his pocket, reached in and pulled out this giant fake mustache, like, put it on his face. And it's like a little bit, like when you look back, it's like a little lopsided. Just like, what's this guy with a giant mustache? And in his mind, it was like almost like putting on this Groucho Marx mustache that maybe no one would even know, but it's like, I'm still me, and sort of like this social anodyne to do this kind of ridiculous thing that's like a little bit breaking the rules, you know? And so he was kind of like that at the beginning of school. And then meanwhile, 3 years later, he's applying to be a neurosurgeon, which is sort of the toughest career you could enter. And he's like, all his professors are like looking at this face sheet with this giant mustache. He's sort of like, ugh. But he was such a cool, I mean, he's really a cool mix in our class of like, he knew which rules could be broken, you know, and that he would break them. And he, but meanwhile, he was like one of the smartest people in our class. He's just awesome. And I do feel like we grew up together. I was just thinking about this the other day. He was 26 when we met, and I was 24. And going through med school, it really is this crucible of kind of becoming a grown-up. Like Paul writes in When Breath Becomes Air about what it feels like to be in the anatomy lab in med school and like learning to interact with a human body in this totally different way. And then he says something like, when I went to cocktail parties, I was emphasizing like the weirdness of doing it because I myself was starting to feel like it was less and less weird. And I was like trying to remind myself. It just was a really sort of intense time. But then you're together so much that it actually was pretty easy to fall in love. You're just like going through this really meaningful, interesting thing together, you know? And meanwhile, it was a lot of fun. I mean, we had a lot of fun at Yale, and Paul proposed to me in the middle of the night when I was sleeping and put the ring on my finger. And I woke up in the morning and was like, what is this ring? And he's like, what do you think this ring is? And I was like, you are going to have to tell me what this ring is. But it was an awesome time. We got married right at the end of school and then moved out to California to do residency here. And that got tougher, actually, because residency, you really are. I mean, it's called residency because 40 years ago, the residents actually lived in the hospital. So they were residents of the hospital. And in many ways, it's still kind of like that. Like you're working, you know, 80 to 110 hours a week. And I think that was way harder than the med school part.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's interesting. You get a sense in the book that I guess how easy it is for your life to be consumed by residency. You know, that those first passages sort of talk about it. And it seems like one of the struggles was making sure you had a life outside of the hospital. And were you in the Bay Area during this time as well, Jeevan, or did you end up going east too at some point?
Yeah, I went east after college. Actually, so it's kind of funny. Paul and I were in roughly the same areas. I moved to New York City after college, and Paul went to England for a while, and then was in Connecticut. Then I went to Boston for grad school for a couple of years. But we all moved basically back to the Bay Area, right? At least at the same time. I think so. Like you guys were here a little earlier than us.
Yeah, we came the same summer that Jeevan's wife moved out here, and then you came a couple months later. So basically, exact same time.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I turned in my thesis, got married, and then arrived in San Francisco in like 3 days. So we were here at the same time. My wife and I lived and still do live in San Francisco, and Paul and Lucy live in San Carlos, which is like you know, 20 minutes away. And so, yeah, we were here at the same time. And I do remember, I mean, what you guys were just talking about. I think for you guys, that being in different hospitals was different. Lucy was at UCSF and Paul was at Stanford. And I think that, I don't know, Lucy, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like there was a certain more seriousness that at least Paul took on for a while there, starting his residency. And at med school, I think he kind of found his footing relatively fast and, you know, was able to, like, make that an enjoyable experience. But, yeah, I can see what residency was, like, tougher on everyone, then that's cool.
Cool. I think so. Maybe we'll pivot a little bit here. And I know reading the book, I think I mentioned this before, so many things stick out. And everybody that I've talked to who's read it, friends and family, and other folks, you know, really all seem to latch on to certain parts of the book and certain quotes and certain emotions or feelings. And the one that sticks with me the most is sort of the honesty and openness about how Paul writes about himself and about what he's going through, sort of the good and the bad. And did you sense that honesty and openness even as a kid, Jeevan? And did you see that mature like anything else? Or maybe you could talk a bit about that, both of y'all, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I'll talk about when he was a kid. You know, I think it did kind of, there's a basic nature Paul had that sort of transformed and matured over time. But I think the root was he had this general intensity, or I would say an insistence on what I call correctness. Mm-hmm. That is to say, if things weren't like, didn't totally make sense, he would not let it slide ever. So, and this was a thing where, you know, like if he thought he had a teacher who didn't respect or thought was doing something wrong, he would make a stink out of it. He would, this is like classic for me, but as like an older brother, I mean, I definitely was like under his, I sort of flew under his shadow in terms of him getting in trouble so that I could do what I wanted to do. That is to say, he would pick fights with my parents if he thought that they were wrong about something.
Sweet.
You know, like very much like, no, this is fair and what you're saying is not fair kind of stuff. And I was like, okay, dude, you just have that fight and meanwhile, I will like not worry about it. So he had this nature that was very much about like, I believe this is right. And I'm not going to like let it go. I'm not going to let it go until like people see that this is the right way to do things. And that was combined with a sense of humor. So he wasn't like, He wasn't like always serious. Don't get me wrong. But I think that basic personality trait, like, was the underlying kind of heart behind what I, at least my feeling, my opinion about how he dealt with being sick. I don't think he would accept a story about how he was doing that was false in some essential way, or was like not facing down the actual truth of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was just very direct and stoic about it. And I think that's because he just don't think he could have an idea in his head that didn't seem clear to him, or that seemed like kind of lazy intellectually in some way. Do you know what I mean? Like not actually. So I think that's my kind of the arc I would draw from his kid-like self to his adult self.
Well,
I like that. I like the way you just... Sorry, go ahead.
No, you got it.
Well, I just like the way you just linked that to his illness, because I agree with that. And I think, here's a kind of a cool insight. Like, when Paul first got the chest x-ray that just looked really horrible, that made us both kind of understand what was behind the symptoms he'd been having, like weight loss and back pain, he got admitted to the hospital the next day just to get expedited workup and go in for a CT scan and biopsies and all that stuff really quick. But we basically both knew that he was going to be diagnosed with metastatic cancer. And we sort of made this joke of like, you know, you're having a terrible day when you hope you have disseminated tuberculosis, because like, that would be better than what you probably have.
Yeah.
And as we were packing to go to the hospital, I was packing like the insurance card and iPhone chargers and socks and stuff like that. And Paul packed these three books. He packed Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
And Being in Time by Heidegger, and Solzhenitsyn's novel, Cancer Ward. And it was sort of, I was like, oh my gosh, first of all, I can't believe he's bringing books. Like, that's sort of interesting, that like, that's the little amulet that he wants to bring more than anything. And he didn't read them. They were just there in the hospital with him. And meanwhile, it's like, he brought this book, Cancer Ward, which is a novel about, like, cancer care 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's Jeevan said, like, turning toward it. Like, the literature he was consuming, the poetry he was consuming, were looking right at mortality, which is really hard it's hard to get your head around mortality and like what it means to live in a mortal mm-hmm. body. And I think Paul, obviously, as you know from reading the book, was approaching that challenge face on, kind of. So I think that like honesty is partly intellectual honesty, but then the thing that I think is so endearing is partly he did have this real softness toward him, like to him. He's a super nice friend, and like all the time, even still, I can hear him whispering in my ear, "You're doing a great job. You're doing a great job." Like he would say, "You're doing a great job." And then I think the fact that he turns that like critical eye on himself all the time, you know, in the book, he's talking about his own fallibility and his, you know, when he feels shameful as a doctor and these various things. And I think that is redeeming in a way, because it's not like you're just like walking around being like, everybody else needs to do better. It's like, it was sort of this like elevation of like the moral part of what it means to be human. Like what makes you good and how can I do that? And, you know, we talked about meaning, and one of his friends, after he died was like, you know, I think Paul felt that the struggle to find meaning is the meaning. And I was like, oh man, I couldn't have said it better. Like it's a different answer for everybody. Right. But it's like, it is that constant struggle. Like how can you push yourself to be doing that? So meanwhile, he starts out the book talking about how our marriage is on the rocks. I was like, you and your literary device. but it's like, you know, it was a catchy intro, and it does show you immediately. Like if I were the reader, I'd be like, this guy's going to get real. Like,
yeah.
Quickly.
100%.
Like, he's honest. So I was like, okay, go ahead.
100%.
Yeah, I think you're right, Andrew. You like hit on something.
Yeah, I certainly feel like he, like you get a sense, like you see into his soul. And I obviously don't, I feel like I know him personally. I feel like I know you guys personally now, you know, and I think that's a big part of the power of him in the book and the story is that openness. And I think you connect to that, as a reader. Go ahead.
Brooks does a good job of like sort of exploring his interior and thinking in a really clear way, which I agree is like, it's interesting, I think, for, I'm sure, I don't know if you feel the same way, Lucy, but like, you're like, yeah, as someone who can sort of check, like I can verify, is that what he was like? You know, because I, you know, grew up with him.
Right.
And it is true that, of course, there's a lot more to Paul than is in the book. I mean, that is the nature of a book. It's a kind of particular lens on its subject. If it was, his whole life would be very long and boring book. but yeah, I mean, it's cool to hear you say you feel like you know him from reading it, because I think it's a testament to his, what he's trying to accomplish and his writing.
Yeah. Cool. So it's coming up on 2 years now, right from his death, I think. Is that about right? And is it about a year since the book's been published? Is that about right too?
Yeah, that's right.
Cool. And so in the year since the book has been published, has anything surprised you about either its reception, or has it opened up a door maybe that you didn't think was going to be opened, or maybe led you guys to doing something that you didn't foresee?
Yeah, sitting here talking to you mainly. Where I'm like, I wish Paul were here. It's usually when Katie's like saying something hilarious or cool, and meanwhile today I'm like, how are we talking to Andrew Luck without Paul being here?
Yeah, totally.
But like in answer to your question, I think for me as a doctor, I don't know, I feel like I did a book tour for Paul over the past year, as you guys know, and so first of all, I never thought that Paul would speak so personally and intimately about, you know, his life while also being a doctor, because there's a sort of professionalism boundary, you know, I'm sure you're dealing with this all the time, where like how much of your real self do you put in public or put into the interactions you're doing? And I think I never would have thought that we'd be kind of personal in this way. And then, but it's opened up this, really interesting conversation about what is the role of medicine in our lives, you know, and like how do we help each other through illness or dying in a really human way. And so to be part of the conversation among doctors around that, but then also to get a view into like the real public conversation around suffering or dying, or the flip side, which is like, how do we want to live our lives? You know, I think before the book came out, it came out like middle of January 2016, and I was talking to Paul's agent, and I was super nervous and was like, how do you think the book's going to do? And she's like, well, it's either going to do great or it's going to do terribly, and it just completely depends on whether people think it's like too much of a barrier to entry to read a book about dying by someone who recently died. And instead, I think like the fact that he's still on the New York Times bestseller list, he's been on it for a year, and that I think says something actually about the zeitgeist, you know, like the fact that people are interested in reading about real stuff and talking about real stuff. So it's been really helpful for me. Like, first of all, I get to talk about Paul still instead of like walking around pretending that I'm not thinking about Paul. Because I think when somebody dies, like, I think oftentimes people are afraid to talk to you about them. And for us, it's partly because of the book. I think it's been the total opposite. I don't know what your experience about that has been, Jeevan.
It's really interesting. I feel like, it's a good question. I think that I was handling it a little differently, which is normal. I think everybody processes things differently. I think for me, I actually, for a while after he died, did not want to talk about it, but not in that kind of, well, who knows? But I was going to say, not in that kind of like, I don't want to deal with it, it's too hard to talk about kind of a thing, although that probably was a component.
Yeah.
I think that for me, I was like, what can I say that would be useful for this person who's asking me about it to hear? You know, like, I don't know. I sort of felt like, you know, here's maybe my point as I meander toward it. I'm at a point now. Okay. with Paul, especially after the
book. We need like a special effect sound. Jeevan's at a point. Ding, ding, ding.
it's point time. So I think that because he wrote this really great book and really read about it, a lot of people kind of wanted they wanted to know something. They were sort of asking for something for me, like to make them feel better or something, which I'm happy to. I want to help people, but it's a little different than having someone you know kind of wanting to support you. Do you know what I mean? In a tough time.
Yeah.
So I think that took a little bit of getting used to, but I'm very glad for it to have an opportunity every now and then to try to, you know, like, help people understand the book and what Paul was like, because I really do feel like it's touching a lot of people in a way that's important, you know? It's like, it's helping people in a very material way deal with, like, the one thing that is true of all of us, that we will die, you know what I mean? That is not something that you get to have, like, an option on.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, I feel like that's been an interesting thing to talk to people about the book.
Yeah.
In that way.
Yeah. And so in the book, obviously, Paul writes a lot about literature and shares a lot of what he read and what influenced him. And since this is a book club podcast, I mean, before we leave, I'd love to get a book recommendation for any reader, for me, from both of you guys, and then also maybe what Paul would recommend me to read, if you guys feel comfortable sharing that.
Sure. Jeevan, you want to go? You want me to go?
Go for it. I'll go after you.
Okay. So, I'll answer for Paul first. I'm going to mention poetry, actually.
Okay, yep.
So the title, When Breath Becomes Air, comes from an Elizabethan poem by Greville. That's the epigraph of the book, at the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then the section headings, In Perfect Health Begin and Cease Not Till Death, are from Walt Whitman's poem Song of Myself. And then T.S. Eliot's poem The Wasteland, like allusions to that poem, Paul was sort of making all the time in these sneaky ways that I never even got until... sometimes even after he died, when I'd look back at an email or something and be like, The Wasteland. And so Paul really liked this little poetry anthology called Singing School, put together by Robert Pinsky. And it's annotated. Like, it has these little thought questions and stuff, almost like to teach yourself how to read poetry if if you're not a real reader of poetry. Mm-hmm. And there's just beautiful stuff in it. And Paul actually, the year before he died, was like carrying that around to chemo and like other places and reading poems to Katie in like a kind of a sing-song voice. So that's just a cool introduction to poetry.
Great.
And then for me, so I read a lot of kids' books now because I'm reading to Katie. And there's this book called Zen Shorts by John J. Moose, M-E-T-H. And I bring it to like every single birthday party we go to for our
kids.
Right. And it's just beautiful. It's like these little shorts, a couple little short stories that really talk about what resilience is and talk about gratitude. And I think a ton now about, you know, after what our family's been through or things that are going on in the world, I think about like the mix of joy and suffering that's present in all of our lives all the time. And that book, Zen Shorts, is like introducing a kid somewhat to that concept, but in a like beautiful way. And then I'm just about to start All the Light We Cannot See, which I think everybody in our family has read, but I haven't. So
awesome book. Yeah, you'll enjoy it.
Is it?
Yeah.
Great. Awesome. Thanks.
Jeevan?
Yeah, I'll go for it. So before I give my book ideas, I have to tell you about Paul's greatest work that was better than the book, but was never captured, which was speaking of the wasteland, he and a friend of ours, Robin Moroney, did this sketch, which was a dramatic reading of the wasteland, which is, you know, is like a pretty intense poem. Mm-hmm. And they'd read the poem, you know, handing off each like stanza, but then they would punctuate it by just putting cream pies in each other's face and doing other like
flipping on banana peels,
seltzer bottle things, and flipping on banana peels. Oh my god, that was so funny!
It's called the Slapstick Wasteland.
Slapstick Wasteland. It was so good.
That's funny.
So good. Anyway, lost of time. I don't think anybody reported it.
Oh.
but I would say, you know, one of the okay. So the book I'll start with what Paul might recommend. This is a book that Paul and I talked about quite a bit when we read it. This is a while ago. It's a Cormac McCarthy book called Blood Meridian. And, you know, he wrote All the Pretty Horses and The Road and No Country for Old Men. So mm-hmm. it's pretty well known. And I think Blood Meridian is, it's probably his like most like densest book, but I thought it was just really very powerful. Just an amazing, amazing book. And, you know, set in the West, and there's this character called the Judge in it that Paul and I talked about a lot. So I recommend that if you have some time to like dig into a pretty sturdy book, Blood Meridian.
Awesome.
It's great. Then for me, gosh, well, I'll give you two. And I am like a definite like steady diet of sci-fi kind of guy. So I think Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell is pretty mm-hmm. amazing. Not exactly sci-fi. And that's just like, to me, it is this masterwork. You're like, this guy is able, he's like mastered the form of the novel in a way that's just, is stunning. It's just like a formally perfect book. It's in its structure and its prose. I think it's just an amazing, amazing book. And then if you want to go a little bit more, obscure is not the right word, but a little bit more, out there. There's mm-hmm. this book I really love called Embassy Town. And it's this interesting science fiction book. It's about these humans on this planet with these aliens that speak a very different language. And I think the basic themes are how the very nature and structure of your language informs the way you see the world, period.
Okay. Yeah.
Those are inextricably linked. Mm-hmm. And that when they collide, when cultures collide, that have different languages, like it can be very violent and kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of interesting themes in that book, but I really like it. It's got a snappy title, Embassy Town, too. So
yes, it does.
There you have it. Yeah, Blood and Breeding, I think Paul would recommend, and I'd recommend Cloud Atlas and Embassy Town.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you very much. I think we're running up on our time here. Again, thank you for sharing, you know, as we talked about, a very personal story with the world. In a sense, and it certainly deserves its run as number one of the New York Times, you know, bestseller, and hope it is for many months, years, decades to come. And I know you can check out a lot more on paulkalanithi.com. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, cool. Yep. So you can check out a bunch of more. I think there's articles and videos and stuff from a lot of folks. And then also we'll post this podcast on AndrewLuckBookClub.com, and we'll also have a link to Paul's website there. So thank you very much. I appreciate you guys calling in. Have a great rest of the day, and really enjoyed talking to y'all.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And apologies for being able to do this. Thanks.